Coxeter Lecture Series, to be given by Professor Stephen Smale of the City University of Hong Kong. We're really delighted to have Professor Smale here for this series of lectures. The broad themes of the lectures are learning theory and geometric ideas in the study of data with a view towards human biology. My name is Ed Bierstone. I'm the director of the Fields Institute. This Coxeter Lecture Series is associated to our current thematic program on discrete geometry and applications, and it's part of a workshop taking place this week on computational topology. I'm going to call on Professor Herbert Edelsbrunner of the Institute for Science and Technology in Austria, who's one of the organizers of the workshop, to say a few words about Professor Smale and his lecture. But before I do that, let me just mention the major sources of support that make the Fields Institute's programs, including this one, possible. We get important sources of research funding from the Ontario Ministry of Training Colleges and Universities, as well as from the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada. We're generously supported as well by the National Science Foundation of the US and by seven principal sponsoring universities in Ontario, Carleton, McMaster, Ottawa, Toronto, Waterloo, Western, and York, as well as by a growing list of affiliate universities in Canada, the US, and Europe, and by several commercial and industrial partners. Following today's lecture, you're all cordially invited to a reception in the atrium of the Fields Institute, and we hope to see you at the following two lectures in this Coxeter Lecture Series as well, on Wednesday and Friday at the same time, but in the Fields Institute. Professor Smale has also kindly agreed to give an additional talk tomorrow at 2 o'clock here in the Bain Center, room 1160, a talk which is aimed for students. It's being organized by the Math Union on problems for the 21st century. So you're definitely all welcome to come to that as well. And Herbert.
It's a pleasure and really an honor for me to introduce one of the heroes, one of my heroes in mathematics, and I think Professor Smale is an example for many who are interested in mathematics, and maybe in particular for those who are interested in mathematics and what it means outside of mathematics, the applications. A few pieces of data that maybe you already know from his life. He graduated in 1958, incidentally when I was born. Apparently he was a real troublemaker as a student. I was reading on the Wikipedia pages, and he stayed true to that when he got 1966 the Fields Medal Award. And what I heard is that he upset the American government by traveling to Moscow to receive the award, and the Russian government by criticizing them in his speech. So that was in his young years. He got famous for groundbreaking work in differential topology. He branched out in dynamical systems, applied to economics. He spent 30 years at the University of California in Berkeley as a professor of mathematics and economics. Then 1997, he accepted a position at the City University in Hong Kong. That's when I met him first, visiting Hong Kong, talking to him in his office at the City University. He came back to the US in 2002, where he worked at the Toyota Institute in Chicago, and went back to Hong Kong in 2009, where he's now a distinguished professor, and he reports directly to the provost or president. And he's again at the City University in Hong Kong. As I mentioned, he's an example for us in applications, and I mentioned economics. Recently, he told me he's now working on biology, in particular biochemistry and molecules. So I believe he's going to say a little bit about this today, but there's going to be two more talks, as Ed mentioned, one on Wednesday and then another one on Friday, the same time, different building. And particularly on Friday, the topic is, I think, mostly the work on proteins. And thanks for coming.
Well, thanks very much, Herbert. Thanks, Ed. So today, I'd like to give kind of an all right, is it on testing? Can you hear me good? Okay, so today I'm motivated by this question and try to address the question of a geometry for these sciences of biology and intelligence. See, I think we do have geometries associated to physics in its various guises, starting with Euclid, and then eventually Riemannian geometry, symplectic geometry. So there are these geometrical settings for physically related sciences. And so, you know, there's much less of that for the biologically oriented sciences. So today I want to talk about some attempts to give such a geometry for these sciences, the biological and, like you say, intelligence sciences. So that's the idea. For example, you could say that in physics, one depends a lot on a metric, just ordinary distance function on configurations or whatever. But it's a distance function which has special structure because it's defined by an underlying Euclidean or Riemannian metric. So that's what I'm looking for these biological type settings. Just an ordinary distance function, but one which has extra structure on it. Okay, so let me say how that structure is going to be. First, I'll work in simple abstract terms and then concrete terms and back to abstract. So I jump around and I improvise. So I'm speaking like this improvised talk, and I'm happy to entertain interruptions, questions. Okay, so there is this notion of a kernel. Let me be precise on this. In much of this talk, I'm not going to be too precise. In some areas, I will. Others, I won't. But this notion of a kernel is the underlying structure for our distance function. So that's the geometry is going to be based on a kernel. So many of you know what a kernel is, or a reproducing kernel. Let me just review it. But let's, for the most part, suppose we're just in a very simple setting. So look at our space not as a manifold, just a finite set. So just to make things easier to explain, in our main applications, that will be mainly a finite set. So a finite set's good enough. And what's maybe a lot of people don't quite see it, but one can do an awful lot of geometry on a finite set. And I'm talking about geometry inspired by classical geometry. So a lot of the classical geometry extends to a finite set. Okay, so in that situation, the kernel is important. And I'll give the definition for a finite set. A lot of these things go over very easily to infinite sets, but just for the sake of simplicity, I'll take X as just a finite set. You can think of X as a set of peptides. That helps. Or it could be a set of data. So X, data comes in finite sets. So X, that's a prototype for our X. A kernel K, say on X, and this is short for what some people would call, or I would call sometimes, a reproducing kernel. It's pretty simple. It's a map, okay, from X cross X into the real numbers, and symmetric. And let's suppose for today that it's non-negative. So K of XY, this is for all X and Y in our set X. K of XY equals K of YX, that's symmetry. And I let's suppose it's always positive. Sometimes that's not important, but it makes things move along. This is, one more. Positive definite. Or it could be semi-definite. But you could think of this as a matrix, X and Y. This is, they're just ranged through a finite set. So this has an interpretation as a matrix. Symmetric matrix, and I just ask that symmetric matrix be positive definite. Okay? So that's what I mean by a kernel. And that's going to be our geometry. We'll think of geometry as given by a kernel. And I'll try to justify that as we proceed, but let me just first notice that if we have a kernel, then we have a distance function between two points on X. So on X we have a distance function or a metric defined by the kernel. So this is induced by simply taking I better go a little slower, otherwise I'll say it wrong. Kx minus ky norm squared here. So I have to say what kx is. If we have a kernel, then there is a natural representation of X. Takes X into K sub X. This is a function on X defined by K sub X of Y is simply K of X and Y. Okay, so we have a representation of X as a space of functions on itself just by use the simple formula. Okay, so X goes into a function on X. And this is made into a Euclidean space, so we can talk about reproducing kernel Hilbert space. This is given by an inner product on the space of linear combinations of these K sub X. K sub X is going to be a finite set of functions on X. So this is a little subtle, but very, very brief and accurate and complete. K sub X is a function on X defined by this formula. It's a finite number of them as X goes through the point, little x goes through the points capital X. We can take those linear combinations to get a finite dimensional linear space, a function space, and the inner product on that, K, I can define the inner product on the basis functions. So I could say the inner product of two functions, of Kx, Ky is simply K of Xy. That's the definition of an inner product on these particular functions, kx, ky. Now, the general functions are just linear combinations of these, so this extends linearly to give an inner product on all the functions, in this case, all the functions on X, or if you want, all the functions generated by the case of X. Okay, so this is an inner product on that space. And so this makes sense. This formula makes sense. I just take kx minus ky squared to give the distance of x to y squared. So this gives us a distance induced by a kernel. And you can write this out. This is simply, maybe I shouldn't write out kx, x using this definition, plus k of y minus 2 k of xy. So we can write out this distance function without going through this construction of this inner product space. Okay. So this is condensed mathematics. For many of you, this will be things you know. Maybe I said it more briefly than you're used to. It's a little easier because we're in a finite space. But this points out how we're looking at a distance, a geometry on X. But our geometry is special and it's defined by a kernel. Okay, so people who work on these learning theory or theories of intelligence, data-oriented problems, they always raise the question, how do you choose the kernel? What is a good kernel? Because this kernel is used directly to do all kinds of intelligence tasks on the right data space. So what I'm talking about now is the problem, find a good kernel. So this is the goal of my talks, all my talks. Well, maybe my second talk, not so much. Okay, find a good kernel. So this translate the goal I originally stated of a good geometry suitable for biology and intelligence into something that many people know this problem. What is a good kernel? How do you find the kernel? Once you have the kernel, then it's doing supervised learning theory. There's thousands of papers and theories about that. The most famous is support vector machines of Vapnik, and we have our own way of using a good kernel via regularized least squares. Okay, so that's kind of an abstract setting for the things I'll be talking about. But I want to bring this down to earth a lot. And so the problem I want to talk about is the construction for a good kernel. That's the problem. I want to show there's some kind of, I won't say universal because that puts it too strongly, but a construction which works to find a good kernel in rather different areas, the same construction essentially. And I'm going to be talking today about three domains. One is vision. In fact, I started out with this with Tommy Poggio, a neuroscientist at MIT, working in ideas from brain science, the visual cortex, partly just to model aspects of the visual cortex, and then the idea is to see that that works for artificial vision intelligence. Okay, and so what we did was give some kind of a procedure, a construction, for finding a good kernel for images. So the first encounter I had with this subject was images. And what we did was to construction for a good kernel for images. And, you know, we claim it's a good kernel, and we have evidence to that effect. Okay. And then almost at the same time, we worked on another problem. You could call it a document. It's a Google problem, document classification. Right, you're given a bunch of documents and you want to classify it. That's the main thing Google does. Okay, and then the third one is peptides. And in general, genetically oriented problems. Genetics, proteins, and the idea, I put peptides here because our motivation was to give a mathematical theory, algorithms for predicting when a peptide will bind to a certain variant of a gene in the human body, because that's a key part of the process of vaccines. One's vaccinated with some kind of peptide. I think all existing vaccines work this way. The peptide will bind to certain cells in the human body. I'm talking strictly human here. And that provokes an immune reaction which will kill a foreign invader, a virus. That's the basis for vaccines. And so what we want to look at is this peptide binding problem. We want to be able to predict when a peptide will bind to one of these human cells. They're called MHC2 cells. And those are variants of genes, can be described as a realization of a gene, human gene. Okay, so that's the third idea. So what I'll do maybe is to pursue these three things at once, because some aspects one can understand our construction easier. So I'm going to try to describe this construction of a good kernel in the context of these three areas. Okay, maybe start with the images. So what is the image? We have a you might say, you know, I don't know the best word for this. It's sort of the back of a camera. I have old-fashioned camera style where the back of it is you put the film plate in, and so this is that square represents that, or the visual retina. So an image, you can think of, let's call this a square. So an image is a function from the square to a grayscale. It could be 0, 1. You can put it in colors and so on. This is a grayscale, black and white image. So you can think of an image as a grayscale. And now what the problem is, how do you compare two images? It's a big problem in pattern recognition. Is there some kind of way of saying when two images are similar or not so similar? Okay, that's what we worked on, partly inspired by work in the visual cortex, which must do that task. And the idea is, and I'm looking a little bit this in retrospect, I want to build a certain architecture on the square. I'm just taking the ordinary square in the plane. I want to build an architecture on that. And so that architecture will be used to construct a good kernel. And the same thing goes on here and here. And so the architecture is going to depend on a sequence of patches. I'll just write out so we can double it three or four times or whatever. So these are going to be little patches, maybe not so little, inside the square. So So this is reminiscent of a lot of things people do in pattern recognition, image processing, wavelets, and so on. But one big difference, these are finite scales. I do not take them very small. I take them just small enough to be sort of the basic unit of the vision. In multi-scale analysis, they tend to take the limits. I don't want any limits. So I have limit. I have these patches for vision. There might be five levels of scales, just five. And I can obtain from an image, I'm basically starting maybe with a database of images on this square. Could be very general, could be very particular. Like we could be studying a database of faces. And we want to say, when are two faces similar to each other? We want to recognize a face. Okay, so what we do is we take these images on the whole square, and then we restrict them to get images on the smaller patches. Yes? The images on each patch will be the restriction of an image on the square. But we don't scale the images. We never scale the images. I don't. Okay, so if we have an image, you can think of that as just a picture on the square, and we can see what this part of the picture looks like down here. Okay, then we want to have a system of translations. We take all the translations. We translate each of these patches all over the square. And that together gives us what we call sometimes a hierarchy, architecture, some kind of structure on the empty square. No pictures in that yet, but they're used to study the pictures. Okay? So that is what we're talking about towards getting a good kernel on images. And the idea is we start with the smallest size image, smallest patch, and on that, it's more or less easy to define a good distance function. When you're looking at a small part of a big picture, then you can use traditional distances to give similarity. Because when you get just to say 3 by 3 pixels, you don't have too many patterns. And so you can say, what are the natural distances between those patterns? If I had more time, I could go into that a little bit. But the idea is that we know a kernel here. We know, let me call it K1. It's a kernel on the basic unit. And then we can spread that around. And then the idea is, with this kernel on the basic unit, we're able to define a kernel on the next largest size patch. And so on, build up recursively a kernel or a distance function on the whole square. That's the idea for images. Let me just give an idea. At this level, you could say, I'll be very rough on it now. So on the basic level, what we could do for the images, the basic images, would be very few. For example, they'll be defined by a line like this, or a little more generally, part of a great circle. It could be like this. These are my ideas. And then you can put a gradient in here. That would allow edges. So you just have about 3 real number parameters to describe images on this basic fundamental unit. Just 3 parameters. So it's easy to work with the mathematics in that situation. You can say when two are close, namely a curvature parameter, an inclination here, 180 degrees, and a gradient at this point to take into account edges and maybe the change of a color. Okay, so just to illustrate that, suppose we have such a construction, and then at the first level, we look what happens up here, and you might see something like that. Okay, this would be in a big picture, like this. Then you might see another one like this. Just two of these make one think, well, maybe two more would give us a sort of a filling in. Then another one. And so on. So you can see just a few here will give us a way of recognizing something like a face, just with a few well-chosen elements of this basic structure. And so that's what we did. We call this a neural response. So these are maybe neurons respond to these. And there's a long story that we have about that. But that's the idea of how, just on this little basic structure with these translations, we can begin to understand different images. Okay. So let me talk about the document classification a bit. And so if we have, let's imagine two documents, say scientific documents, and we want to classify what subjects they're in. Okay, there is a rather old, old means a couple or three decades, algorithm for classifying documents in this Google type problem. One, it takes a dictionary. So this is a traditional algorithm. Take a dictionary, just take the dictionary, for example, of the English languages, of the English language, maybe not all the words, but could be an intermediate size, 1,000 words, and maybe things like spaces to separate words. Anyway, we have a dictionary to start with, and now we have this say bag of words is this traditional algorithm. So what it does is, given a document, it counts the number of occurrences of each word in the dictionary. So that gives a map from, you get a map from a document, a database of documents. It's called a feature map to I guess it would just be the positive integers. For every document, we have this list here in the dictionary. So the coordinates, So the dictionary will say has n elements. Then this would go to the n product space. So given a document, a coordinate corresponds to a word in the dictionary, and the coordinate value of that document is just the number of times that word occurs. So one compares these functions for different documents to get some notion of, are those documents similar? This is a traditional algorithm. Okay, good. And so I want to now expand on that a little bit. I want to take a kernel, K1, on the dictionary. Let's call this D. Okay, that's given just by a dictionary with definitions. It will say, when are two words similar? Are synonyms, or you could say are the second order synonyms, or there can be some kind of kernel which tells one how similar are two words in the dictionary. Okay, so let's suppose we have that. It's a kernel on the dictionary. Okay, and now what I want to do is proceed in the same way we did here. So this is now going beyond the bag of words. This says we take the sequence of words W1, W2, WL. So this is a document. Every document can be described this way, as a sequence of its words, where we count an empty space and so on, or a period as a word. Okay, so now on the W1 belongs to D, and we have a kernel on D. So we can say, if we have another one, say W1 prime, W2 prime, and so on up to W prime L prime, we can say this W1, how does it compare with some W in here? So we go from the kernel on the dictionary to a new kernel on these documents. That's the way it goes. And eventually, this does work. I'm being a little quick here, because I'll give a little more detailed description of this kernel when I get to the immunology case. But the idea is, we want to say, when are these two documents similar? The main thing here is we take, first of all, we have a kernel on single letter, single words. Then if we take five words in a row, then we can talk about the induced kernel on those five words. Then we can run up and down with the translations, like we have the translations over here. We can run up and down to check how that compares. We can take, for example, take the first five words here. Then we run up and down to see if there's something in here that compares with it. How well it compares is given by K1. K1 on W1 and so on. I'm very brief. Okay. Be sure you can ask questions or ask me to expand on something. But this is something which does work well for classifying documents. In Hong Kong, I have a number of postdocs working for me. We have quite a big group doing these things. It's almost all in immunology, on the peptides and proteins. But one of them had worked for a Google-type place in mainland China, and so he tried this out, and it works well. But we didn't pursue this. Okay. Okay, so now I want to be... I'm getting a little more and more precise about these things. In the image case, we never got too precise in our papers on images. It's harder because here we have a two-dimensional domain. Here we have just a one-dimensional domain, so it's much easier. These are just words, a string of words, functions. You can think of this as a one-dimensional problem. Okay, so this is easier than this. And one can be more precise. And one can learn more details about how the algorithms are working faster. Yes?
When you construct your kernel bottom up, you always go step by step, right? So the third level will not use the kernel on the first level.
Well, I'm going to, I didn't say anything here, and I'm going to do that now with a peptide and extreme precision, okay? Okay, yes, not exactly, but something like that. Yeah, so, but bottom up, yes, extreme precision. Four peptides, and this peptides work. The same picture works for proteins and genes, alleles. Okay, so now what is the dictionary? The dictionary is really tight, really neat here. This is for now the genetic type. Problems. Well, this is, genes and they're the basis for proteins. All proteins can be interpreted from genes, and proteins are the basis for all life. And I'm working with human versions of everything. Okay, so a dictionary is an amino acid. I call A of 20 amino acids. Okay, so the dictionary tells us when are two amino acids similar biologically. What is the likelihood of one mutating to another? Okay, so we have a kernel K1 on A, and this corresponds to these kernels at the lowest level over here. It's a kernel which is biologically defined, and it's the only place where the biology enters into our constructions, but heavily. So this is, biologists, of course, understand the importance of understanding these 20 amino acids. 20 amino acids are the basis of everything. I should say, if we write A1, A2, a sequence of amino acids, this represents a peptide. 15 is approximate. A peptide is part of a protein. It's a fragment of a protein and can be expressed as a sequence of amino acids. So these AI are each one of the 20 amino acids. So what we want to do for peptides is to say, when are two peptides close? We want to do that in terms of these A1 up to A15. And the 15, as I say, is the 15 is the average length of a amino acid chain for a peptide. The peptides that we use, most peptides are approximately 15 long. So the number of these is, of course, large. It's too large to compete with, but it's not crazy large. So 20 times 20 and so on. Okay, so we define on here K1. K1 is a kernel on that set. And how to do that? Well, the biologists know that this is an important thing, to understand the similarities of these basic 20 acids. They've written hundreds and hundreds of papers on, not the language I'm using exactly, but constructing similarity matrices on the amino acids. And the elements K of A, comma B indicates how similar these two amino acids are in our basic dictionary. How likely is one to mutate to another? And so there are over 100 different candidates for this K1. Biologists have given us that. And so what we did was to spend a lot of time trying to find out which would be the best for us. So what we did, we ended up with BLOSSOM. This is the one that seemed to be most important, BLOSSOM 62, in the biological literature. So eventually we absorbed BLOSSOM 62. But what we did, in a sense, the people who work on these subjects, the biologists and even the bioinformatics, there's too much things that mathematicians would be less ready to do. It's rounding properties. They're always rounding. And so that's a huge issue we have. I do, in fact, with just about everybody working in learning theory. Learning theory, according to Vapnik, is mostly a binary classification, yes or no, but that's a threshold. And my feeling is that gives rise to huge inaccuracies, because in the biology and in most of learning theory, it's a continuum. Instead of a threshold, you have what's called a regression function. And the same thing here, the peptide binding function, if P is a peptide, it takes a peptide, and if we fix an allele A, so this is a class of the peptide binding function, it goes into 0, 1. And I think the biologists realize that, but whenever they have a chance, they cut off. If it's less than 0.45, they say it's non-binding. If it's bigger, it's binding. And I think that's not a good idea. So we want to eventually predict this binding function for the peptides associated to an allele. That's getting a little bit ahead. But that's one thing we had to deal with the Blossom 62, because they threshold everything. You get that matrix that's most used. And they threshold things, well, they threshold things to be the nearest integers, and all the values are between 0 and 10. So they're lopping off a huge amount when you threshold something to be an integer that's between 0 and 10. So we had to go back and follow through how this was developed. Eventually, we called it Blossom 62-2. This 2 is our own version of Blossom 62. But it's a real valued kernel on the set of 20 amino acids. Okay? So then, we want to look now at the induced kernel on amino acid chains, because every allele, this variant of a gene, every peptide has this form, and the same for even proteins. They all have a good representation as an amino acid chain. So I want to work in the universe of amino acid chains. And so actually what I'll do is we take sigma equals a set of all finite amino acid chains. I'm going to make a kernel on everything. I'm going to define a kernel on everything at once. Peptides, alleles, proteins, everything. It goes as follows. I've already defined then K1 on the basic unit, on the change of length 1. That's K1. Okay? So now we want to look at what biologists call K-mer. It's a chain U belonging to sigma K. This is just the set of all U1 up to UK. K length chains. Okay, so I'm looking at what's called this K-mer, fixed length K. I want to define K2. I can write K2 sub K of U and V. These are two K-mers. So these are now patches of some intermediate size, length K. And this is going to be simply this is very simple, the product. This is a tensor product kernel, K of UI VI. I equals 1 to K. K1. So I'm just taking the tensor product kernel of K1 on the dictionary to get K2 on any K-mer for any K. I can do this for any K, but it depends on the two strings having the same length. Fair enough? Okay, so then what I'm saying is pretty complete too. No fudging, except there is a parameter beta, positive parameter. We use a parameter, and I'll just say how we take the Hadamard power according to the power beta of this Blossom 62. So beta is just a missing. We don't know what it does, but it does give good results. And it's inspired what biologists do too. What is beta? We don't know. It might have to do with the diffusion parameter from a random walk, but we haven't established that. But there is an extra parameter here that I stuffed over at the beginning. And so that parameter is going to come in here everywhere. The parameter is approximately 0.1. Okay. So now we have K2 defined on K-mares. And so we could write this on all K-mares. We could take the sum over K. Or we could just define this for all K at once. Maybe don't say sum. Just define it for all K. That would be K2. Is this object for all K? So its domain of definition will be two K-mares for some K. Okay, then if I define K3, I'm finished. So K3 is our final kernel. So you can see it's very simple. K3 is defined, say, at 2. Let me just talk in terms of peptides. So F and G are peptides. They belong to script P. These are associated to a certain allele or class of diseases, if you want, called A. And we want to know if something in here binds to A. I think we have it. Yeah, this map here, the peptide binding function, depending on the allele A, or a gene, or something associated to certain diseases. And a peptide binding to that allele is measured by this number. And that being binding is a necessary condition to trigger the immune system. So if it's binding, it's necessary. And the main factor in the complete immunological response. But it's a necessary condition for an immune response. So if you know all the ones that are binding, it makes the drug manufacturers work vastly simpler, because just by exclusion, those that don't bind, they can forget about. I would say, just for background on this binding function, this has become a billion-dollar industry for pharmaceutical companies to investigate peptides for new diseases, cancer, HIV, all kinds of new diseases. They haven't done it yet, but what they can do, and this is very easy. Suppose I say that this peptide P1 up to P15, this amino acid chain. Suppose I find out this would be a very good for the immune system. They can just make it trivially. I get in the mail frequently now letters from small chemical companies. They say, if you give us the description of a peptide, we'll make it for you for $150. It's a very small amount, but they can just make them. You tell them the sequence you want, and they'll make it. So that's, why it looks attractive, but there are so many. I mean, these are, each one of these could be one of 20, so there are just too many. So one has to narrow that number of peptides to investigate, narrow it down, and eventually find just exactly which one might be good for a certain class of diseases. How good what? Yeah, we want to predict that. Oh, yeah, so ultimately we want to get the higher the better. It's not just binding and non-binding. If it has a high binding affinity, say 0.8, it means it's more stable, more likely to last longer. So the, it's also not just the binding, but it's you know, the binding affinity. Okay. So where are we? Yeah. So K3 I haven't defined yet. This is simply now the sum or average over K2 of U and V over all UV K-mares contained in F and G. Contained in, I mean, is a K-mare contained in a string is just a consecutive set of K elements. But I'm looking at all U and V in all different positions, all different alignments. So I might be taking, here's F and G. See, I might be comparing this K elements here all lined up with K elements over here. And so I'm this K3 allows this whole system of translations along this one-dimensional line. Because here I'm taking all so this would be all U and V. And here I want U have the same length as V. And this means that there are it's a continuous sequence of K elements of F and V for G. So I'm comparing this and this and running that over all possible pairs. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's a big question. But no, it's those are tricky things. It's very tricky. It's very tricky. And we have we do huge computational things. We have the biggest computations in our computational math center at Berkeley, and we run these things for days, oftentimes. Program them to get it down now, so they're mostly hours. But so far, the best set of, so we work for just set of k's. So this is defined if you take it just a set of k's. And in general, the best set of k's is all k's. But you can cut it down to say the first, I think you can more easily drop the first ones than the last ones. But definitely k equals 1 is not good enough. I guess much weaker results. And we can tell because there's been a lot of experiments done which give the binding of the peptide binding function in certain cases. So that's what we could do is... Now run this, run algorithms depending on this K3. We have to do a little normalization, correlation normalization on K3, and then we use that into a learning theory, well-known supervised learning theory scheme, classical learning theory. I say classical, in the last 10, 20 years. And then we are able to... get a binding here. So we predict a binding function. And lots and lots of bioinformatics people, biologists, have been doing this. So we're far, far from the first. So they've been doing that for decades, a decade or two. And the best ones are Nielsen and Mundt and collaborators. They have the main text on immunology and bioinformatics. And so for a long time, they were the thing to compete with. And by now, we have better, more accurate predictions than they do. So we have the state-of-the-art predictions using this amazingly simple kernel. I'm still amazed how such a simple kernel could give such accuracy. What? K2 and K3, what about it? Oh, I use, why? Oh, because I use this for the geometry and the space of peptides to define a learning scheme. That's what learning theory is already set up for. I worked on learning theory quite a bit before we got to this. So that's supervised learning theory, which is quite well understood, and you can do it best, I believe, if you have a geometry which comes from a kernel. Then it's a regularized least squares kernel. I can write down the algorithm. You just let F equal the argmin of, we take F of xi minus yi squared sum over I plus lambda, this is the penalty function, norm of F k, same norm I mentioned before. And so we take the argument of this over all F. And this is the regularized least squares. This is something I don't talk about much because I've talked about it for many years and I stopped talking about it. But we use this algorithm to get this. And so this uses k very strongly. Xi, yi is the known binding data from biological experiments, which is very expensive data, so we don't have so much of that. But this is the algorithm that uses K3. This is K3. Anyway, that's the idea. Well, thanks very much.
A string of 15 amino acids could well have secondary actual three-dimensional geometric shape. Is that playing into the
Chuck? I would say, as a general rule, the 15 dimensional, the three-dimensional shape of a peptide is usually fairly negligible. They're so short. When they get very long, then the three-dimensional aspect becomes important. But there's something that goes beyond that. Even for proteins, if you look at the amino acid representation as a straight chain for a protein of length 1,000, then the three-dimensional shape of a protein is the thing that's important for how that protein affects life. But on the other hand, the amino acid chain representation determines completely all the folding and the three-dimensional shape. So you could think, like mathematicians like me, we like to lift back something which is not unique to get a unique representation and try to see those things in terms of that amino acid representation, chain representation. Yeah, 0-1 kind of kernel. Oh, you get something, and you know it's not terrible, but it's not. It doesn't compete with the best predictors. Well, when we started working with it, we saw literature which used that kernel. Yeah, we did. Just a 0-1 kernel. But the results are. There were new results 8 years ago, and I think they were seen pretty soon not to be the best. And some of those were done for, maybe mostly done at that time for the protein databases, where you could use other methods to check how good they were. And so they were using essentially that, yeah. Yeah. And sometimes all the other papers put in other biological things into these kind of kernels. They don't use this kernel, even with 0-1. They use, they suppose there are a lot of missing things, deletions and so on. And so they did that. And we found out eventually if you take into account deletions and everything else, it just makes things more complicated and less accurate. That's why this is kind of amazing, the simplicity of this expression. Yeah. Yeah, these are, well, they don't have to be aligned, but yeah, for, as long as they're indexed from the first to the last. The UI means the index. So, like, you know, these aren't aligned, but here you have U1 up to UK. Here you have V1 up to VK. I'm just using that kind of notation. Yeah, so these are all paired. The U1 is compared to V1. U2 is compared to V2. This is not the original numbering, though, in this comparison. Yes? That's a very good question. So this is aimed at trying to give a definition of a good kernel. And the test for it is how well it works out relative to the real world. And the idea, eventually one could say it's a good kernel if somehow it's based, the only place the outside world comes in is on the smallest scale. And then it satisfies through the other axioms. That would be an ultimate definition of a good kernel.
Other questions? Okay, well, that was a really intriguing beginning to this lecture series. So hope to see you at the further ones on Wednesday and Friday at the same time. And remember that Professor Smail is also going to give a lecture on problems for the 21st century at 2 o'clock. Tomorrow for the Mathematics Union and up to our reception at the Field Institute right now. Thank you very much.
Sure.